History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. During the Roaring Twenties, two of the most revered and influential men in American business proposed to transform one of the country's poorest regions into a dream technological metropolis. It'd be a paradise made up of small farms, giant factories, and sparkling laboratories. Sort of like early 20th century futurism meets Thomas Jefferson's vision and dream of an educated Yeomanry. Henry Ford and Thomas Edison's Detroit of the South would be 10 times the size of Manhattan, powered by renewable energy and free of air pollution, and it would reshape American society, introduce mass commuting by car, use a new kind of currency called energy dollars, and have the added benefit of crippling the growth of socialism. The whole scheme almost came off. In the 1920s, there was all sorts of talk in the press about this new city that would come online, and Southerners rallied in support to what would become known as the Ford Plan. But some saw it as a way to conjure up the future and reinvent the South. Others thought it was one of the greatest land swindles of all time, and in some senses, both sides were correct. Today's guest is Thomas Hager. He's the author of the new book, Electric City, The Lost History of Ford and Edison's American Utopia. We discussed the lives of these two men who almost saw the project come to fruition, the forces that came to oppose them, and what came about instead, a new kind of public corporation called the Tennessee Valley Authority, one of the greatest achievements of the New Deal. So this is a vision of the future, like the techno-optimism of the Atomic Age and the Jetsons. It didn't come to pass, but it's always fascinating to see what could have been. So I hope you enjoyed this discussion with Thomas Hager. Thomas, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Well, this is a very intriguing concept, and I was attracted by your book's cover because it gets into the realm of the sort of retrofuturism. The action of your book is in the 1920s, but as we were talking off air before I hit record, I love the atomic age speculative future of the 1950s and 1960s, like a General Electric video or 3M featurette showing off the house of the future, featuring a family living in a geodesic dome and a housewife wearing go-go boots, and she's baking in a futuristic oven where she puts a pill in there, presses a button, and then out pops a fully baked Thanksgiving turkey. So before getting into the specific topic of your book, what do you think it is that's so charming about these types of retro futuristic designs of things that didn't happen, but you see futurists and those who work in technology imagining a future that could happen?
That's a good question, because that's the larger framework for the book that I did, which is sort of a futuristic look at what America could have been, but 100 years ago. So America has always been about looking to the future. That's what we're all about. Ever since the founding of the country, people have come to the United States looking for utopias of one sort or another. They are a religious utopia or an economic utopia. American history is full of experiments with trying to set up perfect societies, because people always thought, we'll get rid of everything that's wrong with the past, and we will create a bright, shining new future here in this new world where we have endless land and open possibilities. Anything's possible. Let's create a new model for human beings to live. And you're talking about this sort of idea of that many of us grew up with, and you still see it now. This idea that we can project the future and we can create images of what the future will be like. We can show the wonderful benefits of technology or new political systems or whatever it is. And we've lived, I think, in the last 50, 60 years in America on a lot of these images, World War II, really 80 years, I'd say. And on these images of future, and we mentioned the house of the future, where everything was going to be done for you and everything was push button and automatic. And the old cartoon show, The Jetsons, that was an image of the future in which we lived in buildings that looked like the Space Needle in Seattle. And it was all about the space program and the advent of computers and all the wonders that were going to happen technologically. Well, before that, before World War II, we were doing the same thing in America. We were looking at the future and using technology to create new futures even then. My book is about these two men, two giants of American history, Thomas Edison and Henry Ford, who wanted to reshape American society using technology. But this was back in the 1920s. They were really in the first wave of people who were looking hard at what 1920s era technology meant for society. And they were both brilliant guys. And they thought, if we can harness some of these new powers that are coming online for society. And they, at the time, the 1920s, the hot new thing was electricity and electrical mass electrification, the possibilities that electricity gave for powering not only homes, but industries. These guys were on top of that. They recognized the potential for that kind of technology. That was one technology. The other technology was Henry Ford's thing, and that was the automobile. The 1920s were also the decade when America really started buying automobiles in large numbers. And that changed our society too. The mobility that provided was huge. The effect of that, which we take for granted today, a lot of people own cars, especially if you're outside the city, you pretty much have to have a car in the United States if you're living out in the country or you're in a small town. If you want to get from place to place, you need a car. Well, that was a novelty 100 years ago. Nobody had cars outside of rich people. Very few people had cars. And so the potential of those two things, electricity, mass electricity, which was just coming online, it was just becoming possible, and mass automobile use was just coming online. That was just becoming possible, right? So these are big technological changes. These came out of the world of science and engineering or out of private industry or laboratories, whatever. Edison and Ford took those two things and said, okay, we're going to create a new kind of world by using those two new powers. And that's what the book is about, is their attempt to create this gigantic city, a 75-mile long city. They were going to build an enormous city along the Tennessee River in the heartland of America, you know, right in the northern Alabama, right in the middle of the what we think of as the South now. But at the time, it was a very open area, a lot of potential along the Tennessee River because it was undeveloped. It was really one of the most primitive areas of the United States economically at the time. And it was like a blank slate for them. For Ford and Edison came down to northern Alabama and said, we can create our utopia, our shining city, our new way of living. We can create that here out of nothing, and we can power it with electricity from this great river. We can dam this river, create massive amounts of electricity, and build a new kind of way of living around that electricity and the automobiles that people have. So anyway, it was one in a series of American utopian experiments. And these two guys, what made it different and what makes the book, I think, more interesting than most stories about America and its utopian thinking is that these two guys had the chops to do it. These two guys were phenomenons of the era. Henry Ford in the 1920s, Henry Ford was the richest man on earth. He was inventor of the assembly line. Most people hear about the assembly line when they're in school. You know, it's this idea that you can build a car not in the old way. You know, before Henry Ford, people built cars, but they were like handmade. People would like rent a garage and they would hand make a car. They would make the pieces, design the pieces, put the pieces together. And automobiles were these finicky, very expensive toys for rich people because they were each one was sort of handmade. Henry Ford was the guy who figured out how to create a factory where the car pieces moved past the workers. The workers stood in one place, did one thing, and the car, as it was being built, came by them and then moved to the next spot. That's the assembly line, right? So the assembly line made it possible for Ford to build the car like at a fraction of the cost of previous cars. He made the cheapest car he could, and he made it as rugged as he could, as reliable as he could. And that changed everything. Henry Ford was, a phenomenal guy. He's a very interesting guy. Henry Ford, had an eighth grade education. He came out of nowhere, came out of small town Michigan. He was a farm boy. Had no formal education at all. And he was just a mechanical genius. He came up with this idea for the assembly line. And he married that to this dream he had about giving for every American, that every American could buy an automobile. There was no reason it had to be a rich man's toy. Every American should have an automobile, because if they had cars, Americans could live in a new way. They would no longer be isolated. He grew up, like I said, on a small farm, and farm life was isolated back before 1920. You were out on these terrible roads. Roads were horrible. You were stuck out. If you were 20 miles from any place, that was a long trip. You had to make it by horseback or a cart. And it was tough to get your food into your house. It was tough to get your crops off your property and into the market. It was terrible in terms of transportation. So Ford said, well, if I can make a car that's rugged enough and cheap enough for farmers to afford, I can change the life of what at the time was the majority of Americans. Majority of Americans were farmers then. And I can make their lives better. And that's what he set out to do. Well, okay. So Ford made his fortune off of making this car. The car, of course, was called the Model T. He made one kind of car on his assembly line. And it came in a very limited range of models. It came in any color you wanted, it said, as long as it's black. So what he did was he stripped down everything for the Model T, and he made this automobile into a affordable everyday necessity for Americans. And that was happening just as I'm writing about this book. So he was a force. He was not only the richest man in the world, because of the sales of Model Ts were going through the roof. Half the cars on earth were Model Ts in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. So his income was extraordinary. He could do anything he wanted with that money because he owned his own company. It was a private company. And he didn't have to answer to anybody. So he had this enormous pile of money to invest in stuff. And he decided he wanted to change American life. So there's a long introduction to the book, but that sort of sets the stage.
And it's fascinating seeing the vision of Ford and Edison of what the future could be, because these aren't armchair speculatives or people who don't have access to any information. They're both on the bleeding edge of technology, and they've been there for most of their career. I mean, Edison, all the things he's done, he basically created the first sort of research laboratory, if we can call it that. And he's, oddly enough, in the last decade or two, his star has dimmed a little bit, I think, because there's a lot of Nikola Tesla fanboys that think he was, basically 200 years ahead of time and knew how to transmit wireless energy, which Tesla had very important contributions, but also had some very odd ideas at the end of his life. So I, appreciate what Edison has done in that sense. So I'd love to hear, with the two of them, they've had incredible success. They've amassed extraordinary wealth, and they see the potential for what could happen in the United States. In fact, they've created that potential. They've illuminated much of the United States. They've made it possible to knit together many of the far-flung regions and fully exploit the economic potential of the United States that hadn't really been able to have been done up until this point. So with all of this potential they see and they've created for America, how does this plan come together for their electric city? And I'd love to really get into the details of what the city would be, because this is the General Electric House of the Future writ large. So this, I'd just love to get into these plans.
Okay, sure. I too am more impressed with Thomas Edison than I was going into the book. I had read a lot of the Tesla Edison stuff, and I know that we're living in an era where Tesla is popular, and I as much read about. My view of Tesla is sort of the same as I'm hearing you saying, which is that he made contributions, important contributions, but that his impact was limited compared to Edison. Edison, Tesla was, I don't want to get into the whole Tesla Edison thing too much, but in my view, reading some of the historical material, I think that Tesla was more of a theoretician. He was involved in kind of the abstract, large-scale view of how we're going to get electricity from place to place. And in a practical sense, he made very important contributions as well. But his contributions were nothing compared to the practical day-to-day impact that Thomas Edison had. Mm-hmm. Thomas Edison was an inventor. He was another guy. He was like Ford. He was a small-town kid without a lot of formal education who was attracted to machines. In his case, he was attracted to telegraph machines and what electricity could do because, you know, telegraph lines are basically electrical signals that are interrupted. And so he went into the electrical line the same way that Ford went into the mechanical line, but he went into it with sort of a fresh outlook, the way that Ford did. You know, these guys, because their education was so limited in an odd way, it might have been a benefit for them because they were open-minded about stuff. They looked for practical solutions to practical problems. They weren't looking at theory as much. They weren't looking at doing a journal article. That wasn't what they were interested in. What they were interested in was making machines that could make lives better for regular people, because they came up and sort of grew up out in the country in the United States, and they lived lives on the farm, both of them. They understood the challenges that working class people faced, farmers and working class people in the cities. They saw the challenges that those people faced. They wanted to make their lives better. And so they emphasized practical solutions to practical problems. Ford with his Model T and Edison with his incandescent light bulb, which had a dramatic effect on a number of social areas. It was, you know, bringing light to people at night was a huge deal. Bringing it safely and reliably to a large number of people opened up hours and hours and hours of time for people, made it possible for greater levels of education, more comfort in the home.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
That was just one of his inventions, though. The incandescent light is what he's famous for. But he also invented the phonograph. The practical phonograph was pretty much an Edison show. And the phonograph brought music into people's lives. That was a huge deal, too, for Americans and around the world. Music was considered almost, I mean, it was so hard to hear good music back before, say, 1880. You had to go to a concert hall. You had to live in a city. You had to have access to the kind of venue where trained musicians could entertain you. And that was a wealthy person's pursuit. What Edison did with his phonograph was he democratized music, and he brought music affordably into everybody's home. You could buy a recording of the greatest, you know, orchestras on earth, the greatest singers, you know, the new popular music, whatever you wanted. You could have music in your home. And that had a tremendous educational impact as well. And then, you know, Edison was the father of motion pictures as well. And again, he's providing people with not just entertainment, but access to information, access to new ways of experiencing the world. And Edison, in the 1920s, his peak had already passed. He was an old man. You know, the time my book takes place, Ford was in his 50s and 60s. He was at the peak of his power and his prestige. He was beloved around America. Everybody loved the Model T, and they loved Henry Ford because Henry Ford was a plain-spoken guy just like they were. And Henry Ford didn't like Wall Street fat cats. He didn't like bankers. He didn't like politicians, just like normal Americans didn't like any of those people either. And so they called him Uncle Henry. Uncle Henry was like, I don't know. He was like one of the most popular people in the United States, just Henry Ford, not because of what he'd done, just who he was. And Thomas Edison at the same time in the 1920s was at the end of his career. He was in his 80s. And he was revered across America. Edison was a god to most Americans. They recognized the importance of what he'd done. He'd made America famous for technological innovation. and had raised the prestige of the United States in addition to benefiting people with all of these inventions. So he was a god for Americans. Henry Ford was kind of a god for Americans. And when these two guys teamed up in the 1920s, it was, I don't know, what would it be like nowadays? You know?
If, I don't know, Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk came together.
It would be close to that in a way.
If they were more well-liked, maybe.
Well, I don't know. I found it hard to find a comparator, but yeah, it would be at that level. Yeah, if Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk teamed up and said, we're going to go to Mars together or whatever, you know, we're going to combine our possibilities. Elon Musk, I think, is in that range of Edison because he's an innovator. You know, he creates new technological advances. I'm not so sure about Bezos, but in any case, it was... At the time, there had never been a dream team like Edison and Ford together. When these two guys got together, they announced that they were going to do this experiment in building a new kind of city. People at the time called them the Twin Wizards, because Edison was the Wizard of Menlo Park. That's where his research lab was that you mentioned. Edison seemed to come up with a ceaseless flow of wonderful new inventions. He was a wizard. And Henry Ford was now in his category. The two were teamed up as the Twin Wizards. And people really thought that these guys could do anything. They could do whatever they wanted. Anything they put their hands to was going to be successful and was going to benefit regular working class Americans. It was with that kind of goodwill that the two men went into this project. And you asked for details about what they were thinking. Okay, let's talk about details. So Edison and Ford teamed up in the 1920s to do really two things. Let's say two things. The first thing was they wanted to demonstrate what electricity could do if it was properly employed from the beginning in the design of cities. And along with that electricity, mass use of automobiles and automobile commuting. They had these two new technological advances that were not being taken advantage of in America at the time. And I go into the reasons in the book, but electricity was, you know, in the 1920s, electricity was still expensive. Electrical production in the United States was in the hands of private companies who, you know, 1920s, if you had a town, you wanted electrical lines in your town, you went out and made a deal with a private company to come into your town and string the wires and put in the generators for the electricity, which were probably coal powered, and run the system for you. And that would be for your town, right? It was a town by town thing. In the 1920s, these small town electrical producers were getting together to form larger groups for like an entire state or a region or whatever. We still see the ghosts of those organizations today. But they were small scale and they were one-off, and every town sort of like made its own deal and had its own system. There were big arguments about, you know, are these electrical companies going to come in, string their wires and then gouge the consumers? It's kind of like the cable television of its day. You know, are we going to get screwed over by these companies? And so the Edison saw what was going on and he said, well, you know, it's a shame to sort of tack electricity onto the existing town structure. What we should do is create a whole new town structure that's built around electricity. So have electricity come first, and then we'll build a city that is organized to take advantage of mass amounts of electricity. And that creates a whole new set of possibilities in the 1920s. Along with that, Henry Ford is keen on the idea too, because he and Edison are buddies. Edison is sort of a father figure for Henry Ford. The two guys put their heads together, and Ford says it's not just electricity, it's also the automobile. And if we take those two things together, we can create a city that is modern in a way that American cities have never been modern. First of all, we can run it on electricity that's made by dams. And that's why they were on the Tennessee River. Tennessee River had enormous untapped hydropower potential, a lot of places to build big dams and create hydropower, electrical power from the falling water of a river. And if they went into that area, they saw themselves building a series of dams up the river that would create so much electricity. It would be more electricity than anyone had ever seen on Earth. It would be bigger than Niagara Falls. It would be the biggest electrical producing series of structures that humans had ever made. They would make so much electricity in an area that really didn't use much electricity at the time because it was rural and poor, could then run all of their industries on electricity. Both Ford and Edison were sort of, they weren't environmentalists exactly, but they both disliked coal power. Edison was always trying to invent an electric car, for instance. He was famous for working on that and actually sold some. Ford never got into electric cars, but he was interested in the gas-powered car, which was cleaner than coal, believe it or not. And both men had enough experience with coal power, which is how, you know, that's how power was generated back in the turn of the century, 1900, 1920. Coal plants are dirty. Coal plants put out particulate matter and smoke that turns cities dark and gray, is dangerous for health. And it's a highly centralized form of power. So you have a big coal plant, and that's where all your power comes from. And it puts industry at the mercy of coal makers. Coal producers sort of had a lot of power because they provided the raw material you needed to power your industry. So anyway, Ford had powered his Model T factories with coal because there was nothing else to do. And he hated coal companies. Coal companies could turn off the spigot anytime they wanted to, could hold up his production. He had to pay them whatever prices they wanted because they sort of owned this natural resource. So he hated coal companies. Edison hated coal companies because they were filthy and he thought there were better ways. The better way to make electricity was with dams. So, you know, massive amounts of electricity, this was a new thing. Large scale dams were just sort of being realized as a potential source of power. But these guys latched onto that and said, look, we can build dams on the river. We can have clean electrical power and we can have endless amounts of it. What could we do with all that power? You know, if we put that in, what kind of city could we make? Mm-hmm. A city without coal, a city that's clean for one thing, a city where the power runs on wires and you don't have to have railroads bringing in loads of coal. You don't have to have, you could do away with a lot of the infrastructure that's built around coal. And then they came up with the bright idea that if you had that distributive electricity, you know, if you could move this stuff around, why not move the people around too and create a distributed city? This goes back to Ford's experience in Detroit, okay? And I go into this in detail in the book, but briefly, you know, Henry Ford built Detroit pretty much. Ford Motor Company plants by the 1920s were enormous. He was putting out Model Ts so fast that he employed tens of thousands of workers and they were all working at factories around where he'd grown up. He grew up in Dearborn, Michigan, which is sort of a suburb of Detroit. He built his factories around Detroit and he created Motor City pretty much. His factories were running on coal and his factories were in city areas. They were, you know, they were like in built up areas of Michigan. And that meant that his workers had to live in, you know, apartments, tenement houses, places where they could walk to work. And so his factories became centers for this population crush. And he found that with all his success and all of the benefits the Model T brought, it also created slums, it created crime, and there was vice in cities. Cities were, you know, the coal power was turning everything dirty. It was not Henry Ford's idea of what America should be. Industrial Revolution America was not a pretty place in a lot of ways. You know, these centralized factories with thousands of workers in one place created problems. And Henry Ford thought his heart was really with his workers, and he really wanted to create a better life for them. He wanted them to have a kind of life he had growing up on the farm, in the sense that their lives would be green, their lives would be spent on some land. They could farm the land if they wanted to. There would be a small town center where this sort of, he had this bucolic vision of America, kind of like colonial America. It was like a village green. You know, you've got a church at one end, and you've got a few businesses, and you've got a grist mill on the stream. That kind of America, you know, it's kind of a mythical America.
Well, yeah, I'm curious. Well, just one thing with the, kind of getting into the plans of the city itself. I wonder, first of all, how detailed were the plans? And
yeah,
I first saw your book topic, what I imagine the city would be like, was something like out of the 1927 movie Metropolis by this German expressionist guy, Fritz Lang, which if listeners don't know what I'm talking about, just go on YouTube and look for Metropolis. And there's different types of scenes showing this city where they have little model miniatures of skyscrapers and zeppelins and things traveling from city to city and bridges that are hundreds of feet above street level. And it seems like every square inch is electrified. There's rail cars. So mass electrification from 1920s technology with streetcars and elevators that seem futuristic. But could you describe kind of like really getting into the plans of the city? Does it sound like there is that element, but then there's also, I don't know, waterways. It's like mixing high technology 1920s with the Shire out of the Lord of the Rings, or what does this look like?
It is actually, it's a lot like that. I'm glad you brought up Metropolis. Metropolis, one of my favorite movies, Fritz Lang. And, you know, the deal with Metropolis, though, it's not just the bridges and the electrical stuff. It's also a hellish vision of an industrial future in which workers live and work to a great degree underground. Do you remember that part of Metropolis?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, they're highly regimented. They're sort of dehumanized labor. That was a nightmare vision of an industrial future to a certain extent. It's a very strange, very interesting movie. And I recommend everyone listen to or watch it. And what Ford and Edison wanted was a different kind of future. They wanted to take this old, you know, this kind of nostalgic version of small town America and marry that to high technology. And what they would end up doing is not sort of a Metropolis, Fritz Lang, super crowded, a lot of stuff underground, or highly regimented labor vision of the future. What they wanted was a string of small towns along the river. They were going to create an interconnected web of small town centers, no big central city. Small town centers connected by good roads. Every worker would have a car. Every worker would be able to drive to work and back. That was a novelty at the time. That was like brand new thinking on these really good roads. And all of the power would be distributed electrically along that 75-mile stretch made by dams. So these houses, these towns would be clean. They would have tons of power. They would have no coal power. There'd be no filthy dirt, you know, no filthy air because of coal power. They wouldn't be at the mercy of the coal companies for their power. They could make their own power with dams. And the workers would have the mobility to take advantage of this new kind of city. Now, it's hard to imagine now how new that looked, because in the 1920s, it was totally new thinking. Now, it reminded me a lot of the suburbs of the 1950s. It was a kind of like what city planners tried to do decades later around large cities by creating green, leafy, road-dependent, automobile-dependent communities with small town centers around the old city centers. You know, this green ring of suburbs that is around so many American cities. Actually, the thinking for that was rooted in Ford's vision, in Ford and Edison's vision of this city in the 1920s. The difference is that by the night, you know, we've all grown up with suburbs. We kind of, you know, personally, I grew up in a suburb. I am not a fan of the suburbs. But at the time in the 1920s, it seemed like an extraordinary idea. It seemed like, you know, the only logical way to take the best parts of the past and the best parts of the future and put them together. Ford was one of the first guys to do that. His vision for this new city, this 75-mile city, powered with powered with clean power, employing a million workers. He was going to make all of his car parts there. This vision had a tremendous impact on people who were planning cities at the time. I talk in the book about Frank Lloyd Wright, a famous architect, who was very a very important city planner, civic planner guy from that period, very impressed by Ford's vision. They thought that Ford was onto something huge, and they actually helped make the suburbs happen later on. There are a number of strains of thought in city planning, but a major line of thought goes right through Ford's vision for this city. So it was a grand vision. He and Edison had a grand vision, and they were going to pump a lot of money into it. They were going to revitalize the Southern economy. They were going to take this poor area of the United States and turn it into this utopian oasis, this industrial hub. They called it the Detroit of the South, but it would be very different than Detroit. But it would be this economic engine that would raise the South back to economic prominence. And this has a lot to do with American history now. But, you know, the South after the Civil War, or as they still call it, the War of Secession in the South, was economically worried. The South was, because of the result, the reverberations of that can still be felt, but they were certainly felt in the 1920s. People in the South felt very bad about how they'd been treated after the Civil War. And they went into a sort of hook, line, and sinker for Ford's vision. People in the South really wanted it to happen.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. Something interesting with this city is that the history of planned cities isn't something new in the 20th century. That's something that's happened a long time. I've studied the Ottoman Empire, and even back then, there's a city called Nevşehir, which was a planned administrative city. Russia has done this throughout its history. St. Petersburg was built by Peter the Great in order to build up a massive navy on the Baltic Sea and knit the Russian Empire closer with Western. The USSR put cities all over the place, usually forcing workers to go to areas they wouldn't necessarily want to live, like Norilsk, which is above the Arctic Circle, so Stalin could set up his massive nickel mines, or Vladivostok in the Far East to consolidate Russia's hold there on the Pacific after it sold Alaska to the United States. But this is something different. This is a planned city, but it's not this type of top-down affair, because you make a point in the book that part of the vision is to stop the growth of socialism, which Ford and Edison both want to do. And then they have all these other ideas, like using a currency called energy dollars. I don't know how fleshed out this idea was, but it sounds like a proto-PayPal or cryptocurrency. I don't know if it's just something much simpler than that. But what do you think is unique about their vision of this planned city that's different from these types of top-down autocratic affairs that empires or nations would do to increase their power?
That's a very good point, because most urban experiments on a large scale, because of the scale, really require government action in order to happen. And you were talking about Russia and their experiments in civic planning, and it's certainly true that governments, you know, down through the ages have wanted to build grand new capitals or ports or whatever for themselves. And they've got the money and the power to do it, and they kind of make that happen. I think in that same line about, you know, experiments like Brasilia in Brazil, which was another city of the future. But this vision came out of the private sector. And one of the themes of my book is this tension between public experiments or the public desire to create these new kinds of cities and the private desire to create a new kind of city. Public and private, you know, this tension between public and private fascinates me, because it's really a major theme today in America, and it was a major theme 100 years ago as well. The question being, what, you know, what's best if we're going to do a grand plan, if we're going to do a big project, what's the best way to do it? Is the best way to have private enterprise do it? And because, you know, supposedly it's more efficient, you know, it's more money, sort of paying attention to small practical details, and it'll get things done faster. Or is it best to have the government do it for the good of the people, so that the outcome of the experiment is for the benefit of the most people for the greatest amount of time, and and has the largest impact on society. Those are two opposing or complementary approaches that really power a lot of American history, I think. What's best, private or public? Who should run this program? Should it be private industry or the public government? And you can track that through American history. Well, this particular story in the 19th, this vision was created by private industry. Ford and Edison were not just inventors. They were business people who ran enormous companies. Edison Electric, you know, his inventions and his power systems sort of were ganged together in his own electrical company, which became the basis eventually of what today we call General Electric and a number of other companies. It was a huge, it was a big moneymaker. Edison wasn't much of a business guy. Ford was a good businessman, and he created the Ford Motor Company, made it the number one car company in the world for many, many years. And both of these guys were well-versed in the practicalities of running a business for money. They were both more than inventors. They were business people. So that was the private interest here. At the same time, both Edison and Ford were idealists in a way. They both wanted to create a better world, and their inventions were one way to do that, but this city was going to be another way to do that. So they married idealism and practicality, and they came up with this, what they thought was a huge winner idea for creating this new city. And yes, they thought on the side of innovative ways to fund it, they were going to create a new kind of currency so that they wouldn't have to borrow money from banks because they both hated banks. They both thought that borrowing money was a waste of money because when you're paying interest, you're not paying for anything except the ability to use money. And to them, that was a waste of money. They wanted to spend money on real world deal. They didn't want to spend money to give to banks. So they wanted to create this new kind of money that didn't go anywhere, but they really pushed it for a while. They were going to put an end to war. This city was going to be a model for a way to make good jobs for people in ways that hadn't been thought of before, because it was more than just like where the power was going to come from or who was going to drive a car. It was really about creating a model life for American workers. You know, Ford's vision was to have everybody live on a few acres of land and farm it part of the year, and then work in a factory part of the year, so that they would have the benefit of rural life and the benefit of urban life. They would have access to phonographs and motion pictures, modern communications, modern transportation, and at the same time, that would enable them to live an old-fashioned American life with their families on some acres of land, living as part-time farmers. And that was the trick he was trying to pull off, right? So it was more than just technology. It was a social experiment as well. And that all came out of the private sector. What happened eventually with this, you know, looking ahead in the book, and to say, well, why didn't they ever build their city? You know, Ford and Edison in the 1920s created this plan, made a bid to the government for the land they needed to build their city. And it became one of the biggest political and media events of the decade. Everybody was talking about it in the 1920s, what the Ford plan would do. And then he ran into the government. And that's the other side of the equation, is the government saw what these guys were trying to do. And the government said, well, two things. One is Ford is a private businessman. Why should he have access to all this power? Why should he control this huge swath of America? What are the safeguards for the American public? He's going to have control over this river. And the river is really about a lot of things to a lot of people. It's not just about Henry Ford and Thomas Edison. So the government started worrying about the effect that Ford's plan would have and the power that it would give Henry Ford. And they were right to worry, I think. Henry Ford, I believe, planned to use his city as a springboard to becoming the president of the United States. That's a separate question. But the powers in Washington looked on Henry Ford as a threat and the city as a threat. And despite all the support Ford had throughout the South and with working people across the United States who loved Henry Ford, despite all that, the government stepped in in the late 1920s and denied his bid. Eventually, through a number of scandals and more than 150 bills in Congress, they shut Ford down. And Ford finally got tired of trying and gave up his bid. What happened as a result was the government essentially took over what had been a private enterprise plan. The government took it and made it a public plan. And they went ahead and built Ford's idea. They took the bones of the Ford proposal. What Ford and Edison had envisioned was right in the government's view, but they wanted to do it not for private gain, but for the public good. So they took over Ford's ideas and they turned it into what later became called the Tennessee Valley Authority, the TVA, a huge government program to dam the Tennessee River, create enormous amounts of electricity, and redo industry in the area. The Tennessee Valley Authority is its own story, and I tell a lot of it in the book, but it was the triumph of government planning over private planning. So anyway, I see that tension, as you do, as central to the book.
Well, this is an interesting point here of the legacy of the project, because even at the time in which it was taking place, the government could see the potential and were concerned that power would go to a private individual, perhaps threaten government interests. So what would you say is the legacy of this project? Because it was talked about a lot in the 1920s, but seems to have been forgotten today. And when I think of modern day examples of planned cities, there's talks in China or Saudi Arabia or Qatar of completely sustainable carbon neutral cities running purely on solar energy and wind energy. And these are the model cities that will propel us toward the 21st century, much in the way that Ford and Edison wanted to make their own model city to push America further along into the 20th century. So what do you see as the legacies, if there are any, directly from the Electric City Plan?
Sure. Well, Ford's and Edison's plan has sort of been a forgotten bit of history. And I stumbled across it almost accidentally when I was visiting the area. I had never heard of Ford and Edison's plan until I stumbled across the remains of what was then called Ford City in northern Alabama. There's still parts of the city that had been planned but was never built, was going to be, you know, the opening city in this string of cities up and down the river. Ford City looked like it was going to happen. And you can still see these, you know, the old curbs of the old streets, which were laid down in the 1920s. They're covered with weeds now. They're sort of out in the middle of a field, but the city, the remains of the city are still there. Well, that whole plan went south and the city was forgotten. America forgot about that experiment and focused instead on the Tennessee Valley Authority, which was a very different approach to the same set of issues. The Tennessee Valley Authority was touted as a major success story of Franklin Delano Roosevelt's New Deal. It was the biggest program of the New Deal. The Tennessee Valley Authority soaked up millions and millions of dollars, created tens of thousands of jobs, built a string of dams, beautiful, enormous dams that still go up and down the Tennessee River, made all this electricity. The long-term effect, which I analyze as far as I can in the book, it seems to me, the long-term effect for the area was, yes, it did boost the economy of the area. But when you look at comparators to areas that did not receive the same amount of public funding and public support. In other words, if you look in the same region at what electricity did and what industrialization did when it was still in private hands, you can see that the development was about the same. It was close to the same. The whole region has developed. The Tennessee Valley Authority was a good thing. It did great stuff. It tamed the river and it made commerce more possible. It did flood control, very important stuff. But other areas of the country that were more in private, you know, that went with private development sort of saw the same benefits. So there is, my belief is, after researching this book, is that there are no easy answers. There is no, this is better, that's worse. It is the case that human beings as innovative animals as we are, you know, technologically oriented animals, we make these great advances possible technologically. It's the city of the future that you talk about, you know, the flying cars and the kitchens of the future from the 1950s, all that stuff. We dream up these inventions and we make them happen. You know, that's what human beings do to a great extent. And then we deal with the social fallout from the inventions. That's, in my view, what a lot of the history of science and technology is about. It's about the people who make the inventions, the Fords and Edisons, but it's also about the social impact of what they do that happens later. The social impact is often not what anybody planned. So what happens is we have this ability to create these wonderful machines and technologies, these scientific advances. And then as a society, we find ourselves cleaning up after them. You know, we try and make the best deal that we can out of the advances that we've made. All of these planned cities happen the other way around. They all are visions that are made, you know, these overarching visions, just as Henry Ford had an overarching vision. Thomas Edison had an overarching vision of what they thought these technologies could do. And they tried to bake in the social effects along with the technological effects. As far as I've seen, that kind of stuff never works. You know, you might know more about other experiments than I do. I only know about this one in depth. But this one demonstrates to me that, again, what human beings do is they sort of go ahead with these great developments that their brains make possible, these technological advances. They put them into effect, they play with them, and then they see what happens. And then the government planners, the private companies or whoever, go in after the fact and play cleanup and make the best they can out of the deal. So we're big on visions. You know, humans are big on dreams, and we dream these utopias. We try and build the utopia. The utopia never turns out like we hoped. There are thousands of failed utopias in the world because the reality happens later, and we don't know what's going to happen until it happens. It's kind of a discouraging message in a way. On the other hand, it's empowering in that we always have control over our technology eventually. You know, people think technology outraces us. We're at the mercy of technology. We feel alienated sometimes from technology. My view is that we are blessed with technology to a great extent. It's what we make of the technology that matters.
Yeah, very good point there that we have control over it. Our engineering of technology is one thing, but our social engineering plans almost always go awry and shouldn't be counted on, which is a lesson that has to be repeated over and over again. Well, this is a really great story of a speculative future that didn't take hold, but it gives you an idea of how visionaries work and what can result from these plans that are often radically different from what the founders originally intended. So for listeners who want to check it out, the name of the book is Electric City, The Lost History of Ford and Edison's American Utopia. Thomas, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
There you have it. That is all for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jake Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a three-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.